Thank you so much for the kind introduction and for being here today. I hope you saw the large stack of books and that you can grab one on your way out if you feel so inclined. So I'll be introducing with 20 minutes of history, but as Eileen indicated, I think this will have significance for how we talk about autism and Asperger's syndrome today. And this book has already gotten quite a bit of a conversation going with societies renaming themselves and conversation online with people who have self-identified with Asperger's. So I hope we can get to bigger questions of neurodiversity through this. One of the things that we can all agree on is that Hans Asperger's idea of autism took hold in the 1990s. The diagnostic criteria were expanded. So for decades, sorry about that, we in the United States went by the American Leo Kanner's definition of autism. And his idea of autism, which was much narrower than how we understand it today, Kanner was looking at children who were relatively similar to one another. They tended to have more severe cognitive impairments. They were less verbal or nonverbal. And Asperger had a much broader idea of autism, and he included children with milder challenges, which is one of the reasons behind this increase in diagnosis. So Asperger, to take you back to the turn of the century, was born in 1906 in Hausbrunn, 50 miles outside of Vienna. He left home at age 19, very precocious, for medical studies at the University of Vienna. And Vienna was a cultural capital of Europe at this time, but it also fell after World War I into political and economic crises, and street children flooded Vienna's institutions. There were a number of orphans from the war, and just thousands of children destitute and in need of help. So you have a very progressive welfare system that gets developed in Vienna to help these children, including leading psychoanalysts and psychiatrists who get involved. You can see Sigmund and Anna Freud there, who do a lot of volunteer work at this time. So Asperger becomes part of this circle. He goes to work at the University of Vienna Children's Hospital in 1931, and he was one of the first hires by Franz Hamburger, and he was part of this effort to help Viennese children in need. Franz Hamburger, however, was on the far right of the political spectrum. He joined the Nazi Party quite early and had a reputation as a real radical. And Hamburger began purging the esteemed faculty of the University of Vienna Children's Hospital, predominantly Jews and liberals, and hiring people on the far right instead. And Asperger was one of Hamburger's first hires. And Asperger had solid right credentials, being members of anti-liberal, anti-socialist, anti-modern, and anti-Semitic organizations. And Hamburger promoted Asperger very quickly at a very young age. At age 28, he was named the head of the Curative Education Clinic over the heads of longtime staffers who'd worked there for decades. So please bear with me. I love this chart, although it's a lot to absorb, but let me just break it down. You can see these thin lines. This is a network graph, an intellectual network graph, of relationships between Viennese psychiatrists and psychoanalysis. Vienna really was the cradle of psychoanalysis at this time. And so you can see the people with big letters are the real nodes in this connection. And here you have the liberal Jewish psychoanalysis whose names you would know, right? Anna Freud, Sigmund Freud, and their associates. And then you have Asperger, the young man that pictured there, and Hamburger, who are really off on the periphery of mainstream psychoanalysis. And they were considered kind of crackpots by the people whose names we would most respect today. And so what happened during the Third Reich, and what I'll be talking about, is these guys are all forced out of their positions, and they emigrate to the United States and the UK, and Asperger's branch of psychiatry comes to the fore because it has real Nazi resonances. And so what this slide also shows is this is happening in the 30s, before the Nazis annex Vienna. And so Vienna's political and social split in the sciences predates the advent of Nazism and formal politics in Vienna. People are already doing this. Okay, so what did Asperger's branch of psychiatry believe? The child psychiatrists he was hanging out with were diagnosing children who they said lacked social spirit, who they were unable to participate in group activities such as the Hitler Youth. And they would even consult for organizations like the Hitler Youth or League of German Girls, trying to get these kids to be more social and feel part of the collective over the individual. So Paul Schroeder on the upper left is really the father of Nazi psychiatry. And he called this readiness to serve the community. And the word he used was Gemüt, which is one of German, the famously untranslatable words in German. But in the 18th century, it meant something like soul. And then Nazi psychiatrists added this social dimension. So it's really kind of a metaphysical connection that I'm feeling with the audience right now. We're sharing in some higher spirit. And so this was this idea of Gemüt. And this was important in the Nazi state. The state really aimed for this purified, homogeneous folk that was not about conformity. It was about fascist feeling. It was about togetherness. It was about a shared purpose. And Gemüt would take you beyond conformity. So Hans Heinze worked with Schroeder. Asperger interned with both of them. Hans Heinze would go on to become one of the top three individuals involved in the murder of disabled children in the Reich. And so very early on in 1934, Asperger is working with these guys and being infused with their ideas. So the other people pictured here, I won't go through them, but just trust me, they all wrote about Gemüt. And they started to diagnose children who lacked Gemüt. And they started publishing articles in the 30s, long before Asperger ever published. And they would diagnose children's percent of Gemüt and the heritability of Gemüt, and they had a whole vocabulary around children's social spirit, and even threw around the word autism as meaning community averse and weak. And so my point here is really to say that the idea of autism predated Asperger's work. It was already in the air of Nazi psychiatry. So now we're in March of 1938, and the Nazis roll in to Vienna on March 13th, and Asperger witnessed tremendous change immediately at the University of Vienna. The medical school removed 78% of its faculty, predominantly Jews. And remember, Hamburger at the Children's Hospital had already purged all the Jews, so this is on top of what had been happening, including three Nobel Prize winners. Asperger and Hamburger's clinic went through the purges unscathed because they had already voluntarily purged their liberals and their Jews. And in fact, as I showed you on the chart, with this purge of 78% of the faculty at the University of Vienna, they had greater opportunities. Okay, so I hate text slides, but bear with me because I think this is important. So for Asperger, creating a diagnosis was a new professional opportunity. So 1937, 1 year before the Nazi annexation, he wrote, he didn't believe in diagnosing children. There are as many approaches as there are different personalities. It is impossible to establish a rigid set of criteria for a diagnosis. So we need to appreciate the uniqueness of children, right? We can't diagnose them. Then, just a few months after the Nazis roll into Vienna, Asperger introduced his own diagnosis. This is a well-characterized group of children, right? Well-characterized, who we name autistic psychopaths because the confinement of the self has led to a narrowing of relations to their environment. So what's striking here is Asperger calls autism a psychopathy, which really carries connotations in German psychiatry of criminality and depravity. And you're gonna grow up to like roam the streets and talk to yourself. It's something that you can't cure, and you're like a asocial on the street. And so it has a bit of a different meaning than it does in English. And this is a well-characterized group of children. So he's really changed his tone within a very short period of time. At the same time he's changing his tone, he joins a number of Nazi organizations in quick succession. And he also begins to consult for the juvenile justice system. You might imagine the Nazi justice system is not terribly lenient toward nonconformist children. And he also begins to work for the city's remedial schools. So Asperger did not join the Nazi party. And this is a reason why he has been, as Eileen mentioned, lionized in history as a resistor of Nazism. As I show in my book, this was not a big deal. Only 3 in 10 physicians in Vienna joined the Nazi party. So a small minority joined the Nazi party. And he was closely affiliated with Homburger and other individuals that protected him politically. He didn't need to join the Nazi party. He was a member of all these other organizations. And he would soon begin to work at the eye of the storm of the euthanasia program. Okay, so this is where the talk becomes difficult. Just trigger warning, I need to do with my work. But I'm now going to talk about the Nazi program of child euthanasia, and that's their term, which is really a misnomer. These children were neither terminally ill nor suffering. They were just deemed to have mental or physical defects. And this was the Reich's first program of mass extermination. It predated the murder of Jews and Sinti and Roma and Slavs and other groups. And it was designed to become a permanent part of the healthcare system, unlike these other forms of mass extermination that were more wartime operations. This was a deliberative scientific process. And the idea was to rid the state of children who would be a drain economically and a danger to its gene pool. So at least 5,000 children perished, which is a very small number compared to the indiscriminate killing of other groups. But in my mind, this is even the smallness of the number is what makes it so scary, because it's so deliberative. Doctors were going through these case files in, you know, excessive detail and passing them on, and it was a scientific process. You were judging children as individually worthless or worthy. There are around 37 children's wards dotted inside the Reich. This is not out somewhere in Poland or Eastern Europe. This is inside communities. And this is Spiegelgrund in Vienna, which is right outside. You can take tram number 47 and still get there. And it's one of the deadliest, where almost 800 children were killed. So in contrast to our mechanized images of the Holocaust, I think euthanasia has been overlooked, and it's important to understand its dimensions. It involved intimate killing by the doctors and nurses that saw these children every day. They knew their names, they fed them, they changed their sheets. And women, this is the only program of extermination that really relied on women. Killings were done in the youth's own beds, as staff would issue overdoses of barbiturates until the children grew ill and died, usually of pneumonia. And a ton of people knew this was going on. There were protests outside of Spiegelgrund. There were rumors published that were being denied in the newspapers. But people had different opinions. Some parents would actually deliver their children to the killing center and request that their child be put to death. The doctors were sort of offended at this because this was supposed to be a scientific process and it was supposed to be the doctors that decided. And so they would not honor parental wishes to put a child to death. But yeah, there you go. Okay, so where is Asperger in this program? Well, you've seen me flash up Homburger, who was a zealous supporter of the program. He transferred numerous children to Spiegelgrund as head of the children's hospital. This is Max Gundel, who's the city councilor on the board of Spiegelgrund. He's the municipal director of Spiegelgrund. This is Erwin Jekelius, who's the head doctor of Spiegelgrund. And so Asperger co-founded the Vienna Society for Curative Education with these three guys. He worked very closely with them. So close was Jekelius to the regime. I don't know if you can recognize this woman, if she resembles Adolf. That's his sister. Paula Hitler. Yeah. Hitler apparently disapproved of the match because he didn't want his daughter marrying a mass murderer, and had him arrested in a trip to Berlin by the Gestapo and sent off to the Eastern Front, which is a handy way to get rid of a brother-in-law you don't want in the time of war. So Asperger publicly called for the transfer of children to Spiegelgrund. So this is a talk he gave that was republished in the Munich Medical Weekly, a prestigious journal, saying that, quote, for all difficult cases, only a long and continuous observation is proper, like those carried out in his own clinic or the reformatory Spiegelgrund. And he followed his own advice. Here are two girls who he transferred to Spiegelgrund. 2.5-year-old Hertha Schreiber, she was the youngest of 9 children, was severely disabled by meningitis and diphtheria. Asperger concluded that, quote, her accommodation in Spiegelgrund is absolutely necessary. Hertha's mother reportedly told the presiding doctor at Spiegelgrund, if the child could not be helped, perhaps it would be better if she should die, as she would have nothing in this world anyway. Hertha did die 2 months after Asperger's transfer, and one wonders if the mother's wishes played a role in Asperger's thinking, because there are numerous cases where if the mother's overburdened at home and has a disabled child and is unable to cope, he would follow the wishes and institutionalize the child. So 5-year-old Elizabeth, he transferred to Spiegelgrund. She could speak only a single word, mama. The nurse at Spiegelgrund wrote she has, quote, a friendly nature, is very affectionate and flattering with caregivers. If she is treated strictly, she will cry and hug the nurse. She was killed 4 months after she was admitted to Spiegelgrund and her brain harvested, kept with a collection of over 400 children's brains in the cellar of Spiegelgrund. So this is also context. Meanwhile, Asperger is working on autism. Okay, so remember, in 1937, he wrote, it's impossible to establish a diagnosis. Then a year later, 1938, he comes out with his own diagnosis. And it uses neutral language. It says this is a confinement of the self, a narrowing of relations. That's kind of neutral language, although he does call them psychopaths. So as time passes, he begins to assume more fascist language. So in 1940, he defines a group of abnormal children, who we refer to as autistic psychopaths. These loner children fall out of every community. They live their own lives without an emotional relationship to the environment. They also react abnormally to the needs of the environment. So basically, his language has become more normative, right? These are abnormal children. They're behaving abnormal. And he's more concerned with social connectedness, right? He calls them loners. They don't have an emotional attachment. So he's shifted a bit. Then in 1944, this is his seminal treatise that is cited today on autism. And this is his postdoctoral thesis that he wrote for promotion. At this time, the Children's Hospital was really desperate to promote people. Because remember the purge of liberal and Jewish faculty. So he was sort of put up through the ranks, even though his thesis was really a rush job. And if you read it now, it's remarkable that it passed for science. But he wrote, the autist is only himself and not an active member of the greater organism which he is influenced by and which he influences constantly. Okay, so here we have members and greater organisms, and I mean, this is fully fascist language, right? And he becomes more and more concerned with aptitude for community here. And then later in the thesis, he adopts Nazi psychiatry's central tenet of Gemüt. He'd never written about Gemüt before, but now he's up for promotion. There's Gemüt, here we are. And he, so my argument is that basically autism was conceived as the psychological opposite of Nazism, right? That it's children who lack the capacity for fascism. And Asperger, who was fluent in both Greek and Latin, might have had this in mind, as fascio is the bundle or the group, and autos is the self turned inward. So Asperger did prize. One of the reasons he has this reputation today is valuing children with disabilities. It's because he said some were superhuman, right? And we kind of have this idea of, you know, Asperger's today is people can possess these savant powers and are really remarkable. And Asperger did prize these special abilities in math and other technical subjects and said they were at the, quote, favorable end of an autistic range. He held a highly gendered view of this in declaring that the autistic personality is an extreme variant of male intelligence of the male character. And this is echoing the gender stereotypes of the day, saying that boys had a gift for logical thinking, for abstraction, whereas girls were more for the concrete and practical. And he said in over 200 cases of autism, he had never seen a case in girls, ever. This was a male characteristic. He did say after the war, while there were no female cases in Austria, in the United States there were some because girls had become more masculinized in the United States. Yeah. So Asperger believed that many of the boys could be remediated if they received intensive help and therapy. These were boys that were worth reclaiming for the national community, and he was far more dismissive of girls who showed the same traits, and they were sent to correctional facilities. So I went through some of the case files of these children, of boys and girls, who were described in the same terms and met opposite fates. So Fritz, for example, fell out of the community. It was impossible to get him to play in a group. His eye gaze went mostly into space. Haro would never play with others. These were sort of a clinic notes written on these boys. But in his treatise, and we know this from his case files, he treated these boys with genuine care and kindness and employed a lot of therapies we use today. This is also why Asperger is considered very progressive. His clinic engaged in play therapies and drama and music. He believed in giving children special aids at school and special tutoring and, you know, one-on-one kind of what we consider play therapy for boys who were deemed to have potential. So here are some files of girls that I found. Christine Burka was, quote, difficult to influence from the outside. She was closed, inhibited, hard to reach. You can see her clinic note there, kein Gemüt, no Gemüt. And then you can see his official diagnosis of Christine is not a psychiatric diagnosis, but it's a character variant. This is his handwriting. He was born left-handed, but then was forced to be right-handed, so it's terrible, the poor historian. She was egocentric, vulgar, oppositional, and underhanded, and she was sent to a correctional institution. She did not receive the kind of care the boys did. Elfrida and Margarita faced even worse fates. Again, describing them in the same language as the boys he called autistic, he said that Margarita did not participate at all in the community of children. Her facial expression was remarkably empty. She would stare impassively before her. Again, I could just read all these quotes, same characteristics given to Elfrida. So here's what happened to them. Jekyllius, remember Paula Hitler's fiance, visited Asperger's clinic, and she was transferred the same day. Margarita was introduced to Jekyllius. Elfrida was sent to Abteilung Dr. Illing. That's the killing pavilion in Spiegelgrund. So those are the fates that Elfrida and Margarita faced, even though they manifested. I mean, we can't say that these girls looked like the boys, right? But they are marking similar symptoms, and they're having opposite fates. So Asperger not only had a gendered view of autism, he had an extremely eugenicist view in general. Again, some people point to his effusive language about the highly original genius of children on the most favorable end of the autistic range, and they speculate that he used the autism diagnosis as a way of protecting children from the killing, saying they're so great. He was using the autism diagnosis like a psychiatric Schindler's List, right? But this benevolent rhetoric was in keeping with Nazi psychiatry, all these guys were writing really great things about children. This was their rhetoric, the children that they believed could be brought into the folk. It was the children that they believed were irredeemable that they exterminated. There was a real bifurcated idea of disability in Nazi Germany. It wasn't just that you were disabled, you could be remediated or you were worthless. There was a solid line there. So those, this is Asperger's language, who were on the unfavorable end of his rage would grow up to roam the streets as originals, grotesque and dilapidated. Okay, so how did we get to where we are today? Just briefly, and then this will be part of the extended conversation. What I think is most telling is Asperger never really wrote about autism again after the war. He didn't disavow it. He just never conducted any more research on it. And he wrote a handful of very short papers for newsletters. But that's really about it. He was more interested in religious themes and social commentary. And, so to my mind, this really makes me question the extent to which he believed in the autism diagnosis to begin with, or was this a strategic careerist move during the Nazi period where he followed his senior colleagues for a short period of time, got his promotion, and then revealed his true interests after the war. So he probably would have been a footnote in the history of autism had it not been for Lorna Wing. She was a leading British psychiatrist who'd conducted extensive research on youths. Her daughter, Susie, was on the spectrum, and she was interested in children who she didn't think fit into Kanner's diagnosis. But she did far more research than Asperger ever did. But she came across Asperger's thesis that her husband translated for her and named her work, what she was seeing, Asperger syndrome, as a professional courtesy. She made a couple fateful decisions with that article, is that she decided not to call Asperger syndrome a psychopathy. She wanted to use a neutral term. So when the idea of Asperger's hit the English-speaking world, it was Asperger syndrome, not Asperger psychopathy. And then she also purged her article of the pejorative language that he'd used. So he'd been calling these kids sadistic and malicious, and she purged all of that language. And so what we know today as Asperger syndrome is really Wing syndrome, I would argue. And then once her work became published in 1981, it slowly gained traction. And then in the 1990s is when it really exploded and entered our diagnostic lexicon today. I personally believe we should stop using the term Asperger's, and I've written for Scientific American and the New York Times and Time Magazine saying that we should no longer use this eponym. And since the book's been published, this is just a few reviews that have also gone as far as to say we should discontinue the use of the term Asperger's. And we can talk about that as well. I just want to point out the broader aim of my book is not to cause, a kerfluffle today, but to really show is a warning to all of us how psychiatric diagnoses can be shaped by social and political forces we may not be aware of. And that they're shaped by forces beyond individual patients and doctors, and we really need to question what may be underlying them as they change over time. So, thank you.
Thank you. It's really quite a work of scholarship. I dug into it over the weekend, didn't get through the whole thing. So you spent quite a bit of time researching it. Tell us how did you come to this topic? Because you've written another book about how the Germans built the Iron Curtain. So you clearly have an interest in Germany and the Nazi era, but why this book?
Sure, I jumped from the Cold War to the Third Reich. So my son Eric was diagnosed with autism when he was 17 months old, and like any parent, read everything I could about the diagnosis. And in basically every parent manual, it would go on about Leo Kanner, mm-hmm. the American who came up with his diagnosis.
And the American who actually moved from Austria, did
right.
he not?
Right, yeah.
Thanks to your research, I now know that. Okay.
There'd always be a paragraph or two saying, there's this Hans Asperger who was working in Nazi Vienna, and he was a really good guy, but not much is known about him. And I had a conference on my first book in Vienna, and I decided to look into the story because I had heard this idea of autism was the psychiatric Schindler's List. It was on his Wikipedia page. It was in all these parent manuals. And my very first day in the archives, the very first file I looked at was his Nazi district party file, and it had this extraordinary record of his reliability when it came to racial hygiene policy and his involvement.
It's remarkable. So among, many of us know the statistics, more than 6 million Jews murdered in the Nazi regime, but you quoted a figure that I was surprised was so low, 200,000 people with disabilities.
Yeah.
And I would have expected a far greater number. But there was a notion that there were individuals in society who were not going to contribute, either were physically unfit to, or somehow had a physical disability, intellectual disability, missing Gemütlichkeit. That is a weird, you know, that the sense of like a German spirit or the soul of the society. That's a very interesting and nuanced issue. So some children were saved by Dr. Asperger and his team at the school, what's called again, the...
Oh, the Curative Education
the
Clinic.
The Curative Education Clinic. And a number were.
We can't prove that, but yeah. I mean, I don't rule it out. I don't think he went out of his way to save children necessarily, but I wouldn't rule it out. But we can conclusively say that dozens of children he transferred to the killing center died. I want to pick up on a little bit of what you said. So the official statistics are about 200,000 people with disabilities. Mm-hmm. I think that's a vast understatement, and a lot of historians do too, because they would simply starve at these places. Like, so these hospitals and these asylums wouldn't be adequately rationed. And we also know people would deliver the elderly in their households to old age homes, where life expectancy would probably be lower than if they'd received great treatment. So it's hard to know.
And how do you research, and what did you find in your research of this folk, this German folk, who would turn over the infirm to an institutional solution, and in fact, even willingly? And you and I also have a child with a form of autism, and I'm well aware of the challenges, but also some of the joys in raising these children. But I have seen parents who walk away as well, who do walk away from their kids.
Yeah. And, it's remarkable. I mean, I do want to say, there was a wide range of parental responses. So I went through some of the letters that parents had sent to the director of Spiegelgrund after the deaths of their children. And some are really heart-wrenching and tear-stained and, how could this possibly have happened? And then there are some thank you notes. Mm. So I think, what becomes permissible can let out our darkest impulses in some way.
So why do you think in our own evolution and awareness of the incidence of autism in society, certainly California has been one of the states that has tracked the increased incidence probably most closely of any U.S. state, why was Dr. Asper until now given such a benign moniker? I mean, I always understood he was a doctor who actually classified and typified the range of autism across this spectrum.
Sure. So if you read his 1944 thesis, it reads extremely generously. He focuses on children who are in the higher end of his range, right? And he thought those boys were great and could be and better than normal people, right? And so the eugenicist aspect of his work obscured how eugenicist he was being. He wasn't writing about the kids who he was deeming worthless. So there was a silence in that historical record, and that hasn't come out until now. And so if you take his word for it, he's very benevolent.
Yeah. Right, because he was finding the pearls among the population. So you said earlier that Lorna Wing's definition of Asperger's syndrome differed from his own. And how so? And tell me a little bit more about her work, because this is the first I've ever heard of Lorna Wing.
Sure. So she was the person who coined the term autism spectrum. Mm-hmm. Asperger disagreed with her. They met for tea at Maudsley Hospital in London. And she believed that what Leo Kanner was describing, which what, you know, today is called classic autism, and what Asperger was describing were part of the same continuum, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the autism spectrum as we understand it today. Asperger really disagreed, and what he published later in life, you know, I said he didn't publish much, but what he did publish was dedicated to showing that his form of autism was better. And so he was calling Kanner's kids psychotic and hopeless and irremediable, whereas his kids, he was even more hyperbolic about kids with Asperger's syndrome than he was during the war. So again, the argument that he was stressing the special ability of kids to save them, I don't think holds true, because he was even more glowing about these kids in the post-war period when he was trying to separate himself from Kanner. So Lorna Wing really saw this as part of one continuum, and Asperger disagreed with her on that. But that's the part of the spectrum that then we've picked up from Lorna Wing. But at the end of her life, in 2014, she said she ultimately regretted bringing Asperger's name into this because she thought that it had become too much of a concrete label.
Oh, it is.
Distinct it's from quite, autism.
Yeah.
And that did a disservice to her idea of a spectrum.
That's fascinating, because in autism circles, you often want to say, oh yeah, Asperger is the good kind of autism.
Yeah.
So it has even persisted.
Your kid will be okay.
Yeah, subconsciously. It's very interesting. So what are the lessons you think we can draw from your book about how we treat people in today's atmosphere of heightened awareness and a desire to act and speak more inclusively? We have a very active group at Google called the Disability Network. Many of us are parents. There's an autism group at Google. And so we do work very hard here to be supportive and to create environments where people on the spectrum can thrive, because there's an enormous range of intellectual potential that can be tapped productively for a lot of the work we do here. Mm-hmm. So what lessons do you have for modern companies, modern societies, schools around inclusivity?
I just think it's so important to look at people as individuals. I mean, labels can obscure far more than they can reveal. And I can just say from my experience with my son, people make assumptions about what he is like all the time, to his core. You know, he's one of the most empathetic social kids I know. And if I happen to say he's on the spectrum or has Asperger's, then they make assumptions that he lacks gamut. Mm-hmm. I would say that
he's got more gamut than anybody.
Yeah, and I mean, I think a lot of our stereotypes about autism today involves gamut, frankly. We were told he lacked emotionality, he lacked capacity for relationships. When he was diagnosed, it was terrifying, the kinds of things they were telling us about our son. And over the years, he's become him. And as a mother, it took me a couple years to see beyond the label. Mm-hmm. I was treating him like a therapist. These doctors knew better than I did. And they were telling me things about my son, you know, that I was believing. And it wasn't until after a few years of being at it that I got some more confidence and was like, no, I'm the expert on Eric.
Good.
I might not be the expert on autism, but I'm the expert on my son. And so, I think the lesson is you just really need to see people as individuals.
So are you on a bit of a campaign to stamp out the use of Asperger's as a kind of a definitional diagnostic in this autism spectrum?
Okay, I have a couple answers to that. First is when it comes to medical ethics, I think the answer is clear that we should drop it. There have been a number of Nazi-era diagnoses that have been renamed. So reactive arthritis used to be Reiter syndrome. And so in medical, eponyms are granted to either commend someone for discovering a condition or to honor their life's work. And so, you know, as I've outlined, what Asperger defined as Asperger's syndrome has no bearing on how we don't see kids today as psychopaths, right?
Right.
And he doesn't deserve the honor. So I think that answer is simple. The problem is millions of people have this identity now, mm-hmm. right? And I think that's ultimately an open question. But I do think in our culture, Asperger's syndrome has taken on a bit of a eugenicist connotation. Right?
And what can you explain to us, for those of you who haven't read the book, what you mean by a eugenicist connotation? Because that's a very loaded term,
is.
And it's very, it's
it is,
well
and I
researched.
Want to make clear, yeah, I'm speaking from my own experience. So my son has received three diagnoses, autism, Asperger's, and PDD-NOS.
Oh.
I don't know. Do you remember PDD-NOS?
Yeah, not otherwise specified.
Not otherwise specified. Just say something, right? And, you know, when I would tell people he has autism, they'd have a certain reaction. When I'd say Asperger's, they'd be like, oh, wow. And, you know, there was sort of, and it's the same kid, but just different assumptions being made. And I do think that, yeah, there's,
so time to stomp it out, perhaps. So do you want to talk to us a little bit about your thoughts and your research on the term neurodiversity? Because the world is neurodiverse. Yeah. We are all neurodiverse. But its application is a little narrower in its common use. Do you want to talk to us a bit about that?
I mean, I can speak to autism as particularly difficult. It's unique in psychiatric diagnoses because they haven't identified a common physiological underlying condition, right? So if someone's bipolar or schizophrenic, supposedly there's medication for that, mm-hmm. right? Whereas autism, there's no one pill that you can take that addresses whatever it is you want to address. And so it's a heterogeneous diagnosis, and we know that, and there are likely as you said with your son, different underlying causes, mm-hmm. genetic, environmental, for different kids. And so in the book, I liken it to where we were with hysteria 100 years ago, which was a catch-all term for women who couldn't control their emotions. So if you think about it, autism's a diagnosis for under-emotional boys.
Interesting.
Hysteria was a diagnosis of
principally male,
yeah,
entirely,
but
yeah.
Overly emotional women. And hysteria at the time included epilepsy, syphilis, anxiety, depression, you know, any kind of psychiatric disorder. And it wasn't until medicine advanced that you were able to break it out into. And I think, you know, science recognizes that autism is an umbrella label, and they're starting to break out different subtypes. I don't know where it will go, but right now we just don't have a vocabulary that's adequate. So when we say neurodiversity, I mean, I think especially with autism, it's important not to make assumptions because it's not a coherent term.
Agreed. Now, I can keep asking questions. I have many to ask, but there are probably some questions in either the audience or on Adori. Is that correct?
So it sounds like your path to this book was a little bit surprising to you at the start of it, how you just went to Vienna for a conference and you happened to find this like first bit of research that you did from like the Nazi perspective. How is the reception to your research as you started to uncover more and more of something that obviously was in contrast to the common perception of Asperger?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I will say when I came back from Vienna and talked to my agent, who'd been very excited about this Schindler's story, she was like, forget it.
Oh, don't bring me that.
Don't bring me that. So that was kind of remarkable to me. And as I was writing the book, I was surprised. I would speak with colleagues that would almost minimize, I think, what he was doing. So Asperger was transferring people to Spiegelgrund. He wasn't directly involved with murder. To me, it's completely, if you transfer someone to Auschwitz, you know what you're doing, right? And so as I was writing the book, it was interesting. I had a lot of conversations with people like, well, it's only a handful of kids and he did it indirectly and what's the big deal? So I was expecting a lot of pushback when the book came out, but I think to present the book with all its evidence was so undeniable that I've been really pleased by how seriously people have taken it, the body of evidence, and that even though he wasn't directly holding the kids' hands, that people recognize how, you know, what he was doing. So I've been really surprised and really gratified.
I guess follow-up question to that. It sounds like Asperger was never held accountable to what he did during the war. How did that happen, I guess?
Sure. So the biggest factor, as I said, he never joined the Nazi Party. So he was never purged from the children's hospital the way his other colleagues were. Second is he himself claimed he was a resistor. He claimed that he rescued children. These were all his own claims.
Schindler, he was the good guy.
He was the good guy. And he was not widely known in Austria. He was not a major perpetrator. You know, Austrian and German historians have bigger figures of interest. So his role was not of interest to Holocaust historians. Autism is not a big diagnosis in German-speaking countries. It's more of an English-speaking diagnosis or in other countries. And so autism wasn't of great interest to German historians. So you combine that. He's not a big Holocaust figure. Autism's not interesting, and this just doesn't come out. And people took his word for it. I will say, in 1994, that's the year Asperger disorder entered our diagnostic manual. The American Psychiatric Association is supposed to vet names. If you give an eponymous diagnosis, you're supposed to look into the person's background. He wasn't even on the list of names to be vetted for the American Psychiatric Association. There was one doctor on the team that corresponded with archivists in Vienna, and archivists would write back, we don't know much, but one of the archivists wrote back like, whoa, wait, do some research, because anyone in this position would have probably been involved in some capacity. But for various reasons, there was momentum to get this into the DSM. So
it's fascinating. You know, I don't know how many of you know Simon Baron Cohen, but he is the father of Sacha Baron Cohen, and he's also the director of the Autism Research Center at Cambridge in the United Kingdom. And what he was very complimentary towards your research and said how Edith uncovers how under Hitler's regime, the profession of psychiatry became the eyes and ears of the Third Reich. And that's kind of frightening when you think of the role of medicine and doctors in culling the population and making determinations about who survived and who didn't.
And if I could piggyback on that, the Nazis compiled hereditary indexes whereby everyone had an index card, or this was the goal. They got to about 12% of the population, about 25% of the population in Vienna, where they would cull medical records, asylum records, school records, welfare records, and to create a composite diagnosis of a person as asocial, as, you know, a vagrant, as wayward. There are all these kind of blurred socio-medical terms that were used at the time. So it's really medicalizing one's economic, social status. And so, these index cards then became the basis of who would be forcibly sterilized. Almost 500,000 Germans were forcibly sterilized in this period. Who would be granted permission to marry. Not everyone could marry. And then, of course, deportations are worse. But the medical profession, you know, in the book I talk about the Third Reich. I like to see it as a diagnosis regime. We focus so much on the outcomes of the concentration camps, but that's really the last event in a series of decisions. And the initial decision whether or not to exterminate someone relies on diagnosis. Right? Is this person remediable or is it not? And that begins with your index cards, right?
Fascinating. So you wonder if there's a modern day view of this whereby you have your DNA markers and you have the ability to select for certain characteristics if you are, doing a lab-built baby. And it's all very interesting to contemplate and deeper than we probably want to get into at 4 in the afternoon here in Mountain View. We have another question from Ms. Strahl.
I just have one question from the Dory, or I have a couple, but I don't want to take up all the time. Very quickly, from someone in Cambridge who's watching at the moment. He says, there has been much debate about how pro or anti-Nazi various folks from the Third Reich were, Hans Asperger included here. Beyond correcting these historical facts, Michael asks, what are the sort of further lessons that you would hope folks would draw from your book and apply to today? He asks, what's a proper way to judge a person's role and responsibility within something like that? And what lessons can we draw from that to the contemporary time?
Wow, what a question. That really gets to the heart of human nature. I think there's a term that I like to use about the Third Reich, the muddled majority, where if you suddenly transplanted most Germans into Kansas, they would behave completely differently, right? But if you're walking down the street and you see a store that says Jews unwanted, do you go in and do you talk to the shopkeeper or do you just keep walking by? But then you might shop at a Jewish store to get better prices. And so most people were inhabiting this world of gray. And, I think it would be nice and easy. And if you watch Star Wars, there are good guys and there are bad guys. But for most people living their lives, it was really a muddled situation. Yeah. How I come down, I think the case of Asperger is clear, luckily for me. Because if you're a conscious participant in a system of killing, that's that, right? If you denounce someone who could be put to death, that's that. I don't know, walking by a Jews unwanted sign, what does that do? What does that mean? That's something that's, we live in a world of moral ambiguity now. I mean, we're doing equivalent things in our everyday lives. I'm not gonna, I don't wanna get too political, but we're all living in a world of gray. But I do think it's important to illustrate that Asperger drifted into this for careerist reasons. He was trying to get ahead, and I think it's just important to be vigilant and to at least keep a bright line about when you put someone in harm's way. That's a very different thing.
All right, one last one, Ms. Strahl, and then we're going to call it a wrap.
One last one. Okay, so from Sophie in Austin. She says, today, unfortunately, there are many biases attached to autism, and this knowledge of Asperger's involvement in the Nazi era could potentially limit how someone considers high functioning and how they would understand the diagnosis and the full autism spectrum. Do you have any suggestions going forward on how folks can better communicate what Asperger's versus the autism spectrum actually is? Do you have suggestions for particular language that's helpful for people to use in place of the language that we've been using for a while now?
Sure, I wish I had a magical answer. As I said, we're just left without a good vocabulary right now, where psychiatry is. I personally tend to say my son is on the spectrum.
Yeah.
And then I describe him. The same way I describe my daughter. She's who she is. He is who he is. But I don't know, autism. I don't like the word. I think, on the spectrum, it's kind of benign and it invites conversation. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I use it as it's a handy way of describing a set of behaviors, but it doesn't begin to describe an individual. And I think that's the important reminder to us all. That the world is made up of a beautiful mosaic of people, and it is everyone brings their own strengths and their own skills to the table. Some unfortunate people don't have sufficient skills to participate fully in society, and we need to care for those people. I live in San Francisco. A lot of them live on the streets right now. They need care. It's shocking to me to see how we have, in such a wealthy area, walked away from our responsibility to care for each other. But to recognize the bounty and beauty of the human condition and value each individual is to me a very important reminder in your work and in our, you know, day-to-day lives. So with that, this wraps another of our wonderful Talks at Google series. Edith, I want to thank you
so much
coming in, for sharing your personal story and for writing this book and hopefully debunking a myth that probably very much deserves to be debunked. So thank you for all you've done.
Great. Well, thank you.